Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hello, fellow law entrepreneurs. Neil Tyra here. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur, episode number 3. Today we speak with Victor Medina, an estate planning and elder law attorney in upstate New Jersey. Victor's going to tell us about how he grew his practice in both estate planning and elder law and has now branched out into a financial services firm as well. In addition, Victor's going to spend some time chatting about Milo Fest, a lawyer tech conference that he hosts down in Orlando for Mac Love and Lawyer. So without further ado, here's Victor Medina. Hey there, Victor Medina. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for taking the time to be with me today. Victor is a geek and a lawyer and an unabashed Apple fanboy. In other words, we are brothers from another mother. If it's shiny and new, he buys it, assuming that there's enough groceries to get through the week. He runs a law firm in Pennington, New Jersey, focusing on elder law and estate planning. And he also runs a financial services firm that supports the law firm clients in reaching their goals. In addition, I first met Victor through an organization that he's developed that is the only national attorney tech conference for lawyers using Mac and other Apple products only. It's called Milo Fest. It's held in October down in Disney World, and I've had the great pleasure of going a number of times and look forward to attending next year as well. So, Victor, does that pretty well describe your current situation?
It absolutely does. In fact, I'm pretty encouraged that I'm referred to as a geek. That's good credibility out in my world.
Give our listeners a little idea about your practice and how it's come to be.
Sure. I am an estate planning attorney, an elder law attorney, and I've been doing that since somewhere between 2007 or 8 or so. So for the last 7 or 8 years. And it really came out of some necessity because I launched into solo practice by taking over a retiring attorney's practice, and he was focused representing school districts. And we spent about a year and a half transitioning that practice, but some political things happened where I couldn't retain some of the clients that he brought over or offered through there, and I needed to backfill with another practice area. And I was doing a lot of labor negotiations at the time. And so I thought, well, I want something where I can control my schedule. And I ended up thinking about estate planning. It happened to coincide with some things that were going on in my life where a family member needed some estate planning help. And I thought, well, here's certainly a way that I've been shown that I can help with that and maybe design a practice that might work a little bit better. So that's where we started. And that's a little bit more about how we've been developing in terms of that practice ever since.
And then when did elder law become a part of the show?
Well, so elder law actually came as a request from our existing clients. One of the things that we implemented very early in the process of servicing estate planning clients was a client maintenance program. And so for your listeners that aren't familiar with that, one of the things that we did was offer a service on a recurring basis to check in on the estate plan and make sure that it was going well, sort of like a service plan for the original estate planning that we did. Now, we would get to know these clients well. You know, we would get to know a little bit about their family. And a couple of times, people would come in and say, well, this is a great plan for me, but I actually have this parent, father or my parents, and while I might be able to fund their long-term care costs, I really don't want to. So do you have anything that might be able to help deal with the crisis that might come up later with their health concerns? And it got me interested in helping with that problem. I knew a little bit about it as in practice area, but I didn't know much about it substantively. And so we made a commitment to those clients. And said, listen, if you stay with us on this journey, we'd love to be able to help your parents, but it's going to take some time to get up and running. And we just started by answering that. What happened with it, which is kind of interesting, is we outsourced the development of a website to a marketing company that we were working with. And they said, you know, we can build in this component with this elder law, which was still nascent in my discussions with the clients. And lo and behold, they're pretty good at their job, because we started getting phone calls that were unaffiliated with our existing clients saying, do you do this and can you help? So it was sort of a 1-2 punch of answering concerns of existing clients, as well as having started included on our website, and then that search engine optimization going well and people calling on that topic.
Interesting. Now, when you started, when you took over the practice, were you a solo then, or what was the size of the firm?
No, the size of the firm was bigger than that. There were two attorneys, and I was the third when I came in, and there was one staff member. So as the person that I was taking over the practice from, as he retired, I brought on another attorney. As you and I both know, attorneys are expensive, not only to hire if you're having them do work, but to hire and pay if they're going to be on your payroll.
Right.
So as the school law practice area got a little bit more volatile with its cash flow, and we were losing clients. See, clients in that world, Neil, they make six-figure swings one way or the other. So school district might be good for better more than $100,000 in revenue. And that might sound like a lot, but that's actually very bad business modeling, because the people that surface that are lawyers, and they're expensive, so your margin is thinner on that. And then B, you don't have a lot of diversification in your revenue. So I might have a practice that might be $500,000-$600,000 large from the beginning, but the loss of one client at the political whim of a board member change in one direction or the other meant that somebody was losing their job, and it wasn't me. So I needed to be able to control for that. And working with individuals, like if I was going to do bankruptcy or estate planning or something like that, if I was going to do a kind of a private person type of practice, it would help diversify that. It would increase my revenue, because school law doesn't pay much, maybe $150 an hour. So I would get my margins way up. And I'd also increase my diversification, because the loss of one client on the estate planning world, up or down, isn't going to make or break the firm.
Now, when you took over that practice and you started adding estate planning to the mix, what were your physical layout, your office and what have you? Did you take over their space, or did you take over their practice and move it to an existing space that you already had?
No, they had some good space. They were right on Main Street. We remain on Main Street in our practice. And so they had a good location for the estate planning. If we had really kind of dumbed down the office environment, because we were working with school districts and we never left the office, or if we did, I'm sorry, nobody came to the office from the clients, and anytime we had to service, we went out to the school district. If that was the setup, I might have had a bigger struggle for the estate planning. But we were already in the community. The firm was in the community. It just happened to be around the corner from the person from whom I purchased the practice. So I came to them, and I took over that existing space. And as we moved into estate planning, and specifically into elder law, we made a physical change from one building on this sort of campus here to another one that was better suited for people with mobility concerns. So we had a ramp, and we put everything on the first floor, which wasn't as clean of an option in the first office that we took over. But as the school law tapered down and the estate planning and elder law ramped up, we backfilled personnel with, you know, we took off attorneys and brought in paralegals and admin staff. And so I would say that I'm down to one very, very small school law client right now who I keep, because I suppose I enjoy the work, because it certainly doesn't make me any money. But we're almost exclusively in the estate planning and elder law world. We have been, I would say, probably since 2011 or so. And so for the last 4 years, that's been the structure. That's been the mistress that we've been, you know, serving, so to speak. That's who we've been paying off.
And how did you go about educating yourself and ultimately your staff on the nuances of estate planning and elder law?
You know, the estate planning world is one made for people transitioning from other practices. Most of the time, that comes from people that are frustrated litigators and they're ready to get out of it. But even for me, somebody was already mostly in transactional work and just wanted to diversify the practice area, there's probably 3 or 4 large organizations that offer some training programs in order to get people to convert over. And the quality of those programs has gone up and down over time. You know, when I did it, maybe 2007, 2008 or so, I went with one that had great foundational training, whereas the other larger company was reputed to not have as good of a foundational training. And then I ended up leaving it because as my practice area, my practice expertise grew and I needed to do more advanced planning, I needed the education and resources that went through that. But there are systems out there, whether it's a National Network of Estate Planning Attorneys or a Wealth Council. In the elder law world, there's elder counsel and lawyers with a purpose, which is the next version of an organization used to call Medicaid practice systems, which is what I knew it when I was kind of getting into elder law. But they will give you not only the substantive training, but also access to the drafting software and access to a great listserv where you can ask questions. I'll take the other half of your question and probably take a little bit of exception if I'm being candid, because I'm not sure that I'm great in training the rest of our staff along the way. I think one of the challenges is really kind of bringing that information over. The systems work very well, but I'm not sure that there are many people on the team that have the same substantive knowledge to work independently that I gained either through the original training program or through actually practicing in the area.
Well, staff training continues to be a challenge in just about all law practices, and I think that this is not any different.
No, not at all. And I've said to people, I appreciate your kind words that I'm successful. I think a little too humble to agree. But if I have any success and we've been able to maintain it, the outflow of that is that the biggest thing that determines my future success is not going to be the ability to attract and retain clients. Those tend to be pretty well-developed systems. The success is really in the difference between attracting, hiring, training and retaining great team members, and that's a challenge. Not many lawyers are born great managers. In fact, I'd probably suggest that most of them are born terrible managers. And the training systems that are available are not as ubiquitous as the ones in the substantive areas. You can always find a continuing education program on the newest tax law or how to do a real estate closing, but the actual skill of managing people is far rarer, something to go and learn some out in the marketplace.
Well, that's one of the exact reasons for this podcast in the first place, is that the business side of running a law firm is not something that's either taught in the law schools, nor in the bar associations that we are members of. And so it becomes a real challenge, is how does either a young attorney or a transitioning attorney, how do they learn to do the business of their law practice and make that a thriving endeavor while at the same time maintaining their legal skills?
Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
And so from your perspective, I was going to ask you the next question would be, what's your biggest challenge in this arena? But I think you've already covered it. It would be in the acquisition, selection, training of your staff members?
Yeah, I would say that's probably accurate. And if I had to dive down into the biggest challenge, it's really in the ability to develop a set of training manuals that will allow me to get people up and running quickly. Because some of the largest investments that I make of my own time and resources is in bringing new staff members up to speed. I think we've done good work in learning how to attract good candidates. But even the best candidates take some time to, you know, shake out one way or the other if they're going to be any good. But also bringing them up to speed so that they can do their job effectively, the more you can systematize that process and make the onboarding something that is done without an investment of your time, training manuals, videos, whatever else, the better that will be. I've made minor strides in that front. So one of the things that is big in the estate planning world are automated systems for drafting plans, because the actual work of developing the paper at the end is not a high skill level job. It's really something that if you follow a system and a process, you should be able to do. But the program itself is not intuitive. And if you don't come from an estate planning background, regardless of whether or not you've used that particular computer system before, well, it's going to seem like absolute gibberish to you as you get in there. So a buddy of mine who's a lawyer in Chicago and the Chicago area, and he's actually a recovering programmer, it turns out that he came up with a suggestion that worked well. It's kind of, he had feet in both of those worlds. He says, well, why don't you create a video series and keep it between 1 and 3 minutes that people can refer back to of you going through a plan? And so kind of marrying my geek cred with my substantive law skills, I was able to pull up a screencast program, just dive in, do 1 to 3 minutes in each of the sections of what we're doing, and be able to train people on drafting. and keep that video series up and going. But here's the failing of how stupid I am, which is that we've done it for one of the systems, but not the other, right? So who has to keep drafting and who has to invest all the time to train somebody? Me, because I'm still not done with the other side because I can't even learn from my own successful lesson.
Well, still, I mean, I was going to get to the point of what systems are you employing within your office space to meet the challenges. And this sounds like your video series is certainly one of them.
It's been very helpful. It's no secret that we had the mass bloodletting of 2014, in which we cut most of our staff and started over. But as we brought new people on, what ended up happening was that we could start fresh with them. And we had to do a lot of that training in a lot of different areas. We brought in 3-4 new staff members and essentially just ramped up from the beginning. Well, the video series has been successful. Other things that have helped with that have been graphic representations of what we do. So workflows and actually using the programs that we have available on the computer to bring up flowcharts and make them quickly and developing that muscle as a skill set so that we can apply it in various areas. You know, the more you use that skill set, the easier it comes to do the second and third iteration of whatever you need to get done. And it doesn't feel like you're making it from whole cloth every single day.
And I assume that you're spending time on an ongoing basis, keeping those products, those graphic training devices up to date.
That sounds like a great idea, Neil. I would love to be able to do that. No, I mean, you're right. It definitely is the right thing to do. I will tell you that some of the biggest challenges are in carving out those implementation times within our practice. Not just because we're busy or, you know, that it's taking time away. It's hard to keep that time sacred. I have a team leader here, Juliana, who helps me in that front. I mean, one of the staff members, staff positions that we have is as a chief operating officer. She's not related to the implementation of whatever client work that we've accepted on. She's purely operational. And one of the goals that we have for her is exactly as you suggest, you know, looking at all the forms and processes and all of the tools and keeping them up to date because they will change as life changes.
Sure.
And as well as finding better efficiencies by doing something differently or over time, or staff members, you know, pick up on a little tweak that will make it so much better. Well, her job is to keep those up to date. And it is a challenge, you know, because she's also the person training admin staff and doing the things that, frankly, I don't know. I couldn't train somebody on how to do a FedEx. I haven't done one, I don't know how many years. I don't even know where the program is. So, you know, she has those challenges because there's information that she has that's different than what I have.
Well, you've described the physical layout of your practice and to some degree, some of the staffing. Can you go through your staffing and just tell us, you know, who you have in your office in terms of job descriptions and what it is they do to support your endeavor?
So it's changed over time. I've been as large as 9 staff members. We are 5 now. I've been as small as 2 with 2 temp people just to help. And what I've tried to think about is ways of segregating out activities so that we have the right skilled person in each of those roles. And what I mean by that, so it doesn't sound like a lot of double talk, is, you know, I don't want, it would be, I would pay $100 an hour for a person who can do $100 an hour work and could fill 40 hours a week of doing that. What's hard is that as the nature of this practice evolves, as we add in new things like the financial services practice that we have, it's very difficult to keep that as a static thing. And so we've had 5 staff members, we're at 5 now, and they're generally broken out into myself, who's the chief strategist and the person who generates revenue by meeting with clients. We have a marketing assistant whose job it is to keep us top of mind with our referral sources and people in the community. I have the operations director that I mentioned, Juliana. I have a drafting paralegal who works just on creating the plans. And then I have a client services person who's there to manage clients, not really just answer the phone like a receptionist, but triage matters back and forth, sort of work as a project manager on actual case load. And that's where we are right now. Could I use 2 more people? Probably, but I wouldn't say that we had the revenue to support that right now. We've deliberately scaled down as we have put more resources behind the financial services work that we're doing, which is related to and an extension of the estate planning work that we're doing for clients. So we're deliberately at that size. And I think that there's probably some ideal size that you can get to, in which case those job descriptions would get refined a little bit, but that's kind of where we're at now.
So right now you're the only attorney in the firm.
That's correct.
Okay. And the financial services part of your business, are you staffing that independently of the law firm?
Poor Juliana. She takes on every job that I ask her to do. So independent, no. She works on both fronts. But one of the things that I've tried to do with the creation of that business is take the lessons that I've learned in the legal world about practice management and development and apply them from the beginning. You know, as you may have suggested, you know, learning from your prior mistakes is a pretty regular occurrence for most people. And most people learn from their mistakes in sort of an iterative fashion, right? Every step along the way. Now I have the chance, kind of starting with a clean slate, to apply all of that knowledge and not screw it up from the beginning. So one of the things that we try to do is look at those low-level tasks that are related to financial services, these back office things, and just hire them out from the beginning. Just outsource those activities so that we can retain the highest level work, the most profitable work that we need to from the outset. And so, I really don't need anybody right now. I could probably grow to 4 or 5 times my size on the financial side and still not need any more people than I currently have. Where I see in the future an interesting bend in the road is going to be when the time required to service the financial services business starts to exceed the time allotted for the legal. And not because we won't be able to do both, but I don't know what that's going to mean for the personnel structure on the legal. If the margins on the financial side are higher, and if the staffing needs are lower, well, I can't just kind of replace those people and kind of slide them over from legal to financial, where there's going to be some attrition or shrinkage on that front. So I'm going to have to play with what that looks like, especially as I try to develop the skill set for the people that are working for me in the legal so that they continue to have a job in the future as things change.
Now, you've touched on it at various points here, and we introduced you as a geek, which I think is a well-earned title. Tell us a little bit about how technology plays a role in the success of your firm.
So we are an all Mac office, which when we did that 8 years ago was an anomaly. It certainly was something to kind of raise your eyebrows at. Well, how smart could you really be if you've decided to make that part of your firm?
Really?
Right. We've both been there in a life cycle. And most people would have looked at that 8 years ago and kind of tisk their way through the rest of the week. But since then, with the development of all kinds of tools that have helped with that, and certainly the halo effect of some of the mobile devices that they've put out, you know, Apple becomes an acceptable way of setting up your firm. Well, when I did that 8 years ago, one of the happy byproducts is that although I was paying more for my hardware in the beginning, it lasted longer. Although I had some compromised solutions back in that day, software-wise, they were rock solid. I never had an expense for IT. I didn't have any downtime. You know, we were able to set up things on my own. And maybe I was slightly more skilled at kind of managing our own IT, setting up somebody's computer and whatnot. But I didn't think it was all that difficult. And that gave us some savings. But it also informed an approach about how a technology is supposed to serve the practice and the practice not serve technology in the reverse, that has continued with this, even as the tools have become easier over time. And what I mean by that is that the technology really serves our purposes. It is there to be the lubricant that keeps the gears moving smoothly. And, you know, anything that we do, the technology is a way of increasing efficiency, kind of a maximizing effectiveness in what we're doing. And that's really what we look at those tools. We don't implement something unless it really kind of serves a profit motive, right? Can we shrink the expense of getting something done or increases a deliverable, kind of helps us on the value side. And that's kind of we integrate those two.
Or I'm thinking that it's also a view towards the client engagement and their experience. I know you use iPads pretty extensively in your practice, and that certainly brings a level of sophistication when you're interacting with the client base, does it not?
It does. In fact, back in the day, estate planning attorneys used to buy these very expensive PANA boards, which was essentially this $4,000 device that you stuck on the wall. It was a sliding whiteboard. Right. So it would have four panels, and then you'd hit a button, and it would print out whatever you were writing on. Well, I didn't have $4,000, but I did have an iPad that was probably, you know, $600-700. I had an Apple TV that was $100, and I had a TV that wasn't working too hard. And between that and wireless and the ability to kind of plug stuff up, I had an instant whiteboard that had as many panels as I needed, and it would allow me to engage the client a little bit better because I would sit right next to the client as opposed to standing up on the board like a professor, and we'd be able to draw things together. That's a byproduct of recognizing when a technology tool that you have might serve a purpose of something else, but it's just a happy accident. You know, I didn't develop the iPad. I didn't go into estate planning thinking I'd be using it that way. But once they gave me the blank slate and said, here's what you can do with it, you know, we kind of rolled that out to be, you know, that had some merit, being able to diagram things for clients. Let's figure out how our tools are going to work with that.
And we've talked now about, you know, your entrepreneurial entree into the practice of law and now your financial services firm. What, Victor, do you think is your best entrepreneurial skill?
Oh, geez. So there are probably two things that I think I attribute any success that I've had to. One is I don't have any problem trying something new. And just as importantly, I've developed a muscle habit of being rewarded by doing that with some success. So if I was trying a bunch of new stuff and I kept failing at it, I suppose I would have learned the lesson to stop listening to that instinct because you suck at it, right? Mm-hmm. But I've been able to kind of be rewarded by that front and by those efforts and develop something that has turned out to be successful over time. So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect of it is I'm never down for too long. So these are related, but even as things have failed and turned out not to be what we wanted, or we've been faced with challenges, those in my mind are temporary. The future is bright. And I always have a vision that goes beyond my current circumstances, even as those circumstances might be more dire today than they have been in the last 6 months. There's a saying from a friend of mine who's an attorney coach that says, your vision is only as far as your cash flow. You know, how far you can see is only as how much is in your operating account. I don't suffer from that too much. I mean, I certainly have to attend to things that are crisis in the moment if they're business related, but I've always been able to keep an eye towards what the future looks like. And, you know, anything that knocks us off the path doesn't do it for too long. And we're back on it pretty quickly.
And I'll just offer my own personal observation, having known Victor now for many years, just a more engaging guy you're not going to meet. So I'm sure that your success in part can be traced to your ability to engage on a personal level with your clients, with your peers in the industry, and just with everybody around you. I think it's a great skill.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So as we kind of wrap up here, Victor, I know that you're a fellow who pays a lot of attention to those who are writing in the entrepreneur and tech space. Do you have a book or a resource that you think our listeners would particularly benefit from in developing their own law practices?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to give you one that's off the beaten path. You know, we have both gone through programs that reading books and assignments on books has been a part of how we learn.
Right.
And I think that there's probably going to be enough people offering those to your listeners that you were going to cover those bases. But I've really been turned on by a book in the financial services realm. Now, before everyone stops listening, it's not really about developing a financial services firm, but they take the principles about thinking about your practice as a business and thinking about the long tail of where you're trying to get to and give some very clear advice. I mean, I've never read a book that sounded more like the coaching programs that I love than this one. And so the name of that book is actually called Practice Made More Perfect. And so it's a follow-up book where the practice, it was first called Practice Made Perfect, but then they kind of came up with an updated version as Practice Made More Perfect. It's written by Mark Tibergen, and that's Tibergien, and Rebecca Pomering, and it's Pomering. It's maybe $30 or $40. Why? Because they figure that people in the financial services have will pay more money for stuff, right? Yeah, they're going to have some money to pay for it. But it is discounted on Amazon from $80 down to $40. So it's about half price. And you can get it on Kindle. But there are tools in there. There's very clear thinking and teaching in there. And I would absolutely recommend that. I've really been turned on by that book because it helps in the creation of an advisory firm thinking about things from the operations perspective, technology, how you hire, how you reward the people that you bring in, how you structure the business so it's not dependent on you as the hero, you know, but has a life cycle and viability that goes beyond the principal shareholder, the person who's developing it. And I think it'd be a great book for them to read.
Well, it sounds like a great idea. A little off the beaten path, as you said, but that's where the knowledge is to be found. Victor, as we wrap this up here, tell our listeners where they can or how they can get a hold of you, what your law firm's website is, so they can take a little peek at that. And then give us a little bit on Milo Fest and what to expect next year.
Great. So we have two websites that kind of serve our big businesses. And so one of them is at MedinaLawGroup.com. And my last name is spelled M-E-D-I-N-A. And then the website's L-A-W-G-R-O-U-P. Our financial services website is Private Client Capital Group. So Private Client and CAPITALGROUP.com. And those are the big websites for those two companies. For MiloFest, it's actually located at MiloFest.com, and it's M-I-L-O-F-E-S-T. MiloFest is just a wonderful gathering of attorneys. Like-minded in the way that they use Apple products in their practice, but it has just had this wonderful byproduct of attracting a collegial group of individuals that learn from each other. The time that they spend and the relationships that they develop are outstanding. It was just such a wonderful byproduct to see that the people that go there are people that I would love to hang out with. I don't know how many lawyer things I've gone to that I wouldn't have a beer with anybody that's there, but it's the opposite with Milo Fest. And it's a 2 to 3 day conference that is located at Disney World Properties. We have been holding it at the Disney Yacht and Beach Club for the past few years, and that's where we'll be next year. The dates for that are October 6th through the 8th, so it's right before Columbus Day weekend. And if you wanted to bring the family down, it is an absolute great time to do that. The weather's fantastic. You're there during the Food and Wine Festival. The room rates that we secure for the Yacht Beach Club are almost 50% of the rates for that same weekend, so people can do so affordably and be able to extend their stay and still get the same great deal for being there. But the conference costs a little bit of money. I'll be fair with you. I actually don't make a lot of profit on it. It's a labor of love. There are a couple of bucks left over. It doesn't cost me anything to go, is basically how I get rewarded. But it all goes to the food and the location, and we have wonderful speakers. So if it's something that you wanted to think about ways to enhance your practice, it's a great blend of not only thinking about technology, but also other practice management things. The speakers that we have there are really, you know, helping you think about, you know, life and law and technology and your practice management. And it's a blend of all of those things together for about 2.5 days.
And I will say that I've had the pleasure of going on multiple occasions to Milo Fest, and it's not just an all Mac, all Apple environment, although significantly that's the dominant platforms there. But I've, you know, benefited from the speaking and the engagement of, you know, marketers like Smart Marketing and Mark Miranda, who's there every year, and fellas the case management software, the folks from Clio and Rocket Matter, who have been phenomenal. So if our listeners, if you're looking for a great, as you said, lawyer tech conference, small enough to be personal, Milo Fest is the way to go. Victor, thanks ever so much for being a part of our show. I appreciate you coming on, and I wish you all the best for 2016, and we'll be in touch from here on out.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks so much for having me. Same to you.
Thank you. Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.